Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580, our morning talk program. My name is David Inge, and we're glad to have you with us. Before we get going through here, I just want to pass on a little local news note to you from the city of Champaign. The sheriff and the police chief, Sheriff Walsh and Chief Finney, are advising that today's law enforcement memorial service at Westside Park is being canceled due to thunderstorms moving into the area. Information about a future date not available at this time. If we get more information on that, we'll certainly pass it on to you. This morning in this hour of Focus 580, we'll be talking with a man who has been called the evangelist of entrepreneurship. His name is Carl Schramm, and he is the president and CEO of the Kauffman Foundation. That's a private philanthropic foundation that's devoted to entrepreneurship and education. He says that Americans really don't appreciate the fact that the secret to our success lies in our skill as entrepreneurs. That alone, he says, can give us the leverage to remain an economic superpower. This morning, we'll try to talk about what this means for the way we lead corporations, the way we run universities, and also the way we decide where and how we work. And of course, questions and comments from people who are listening are welcome. Our guest, Carl Schramm, will be here in Champaign-Urbana this weekend. He is one of actually two commencement speakers. You heard about one just a moment ago, Susie Orman. She is speaking at the morning ceremony. And then our guest, Carl Schramm, will be the speaker at the afternoon ceremony. This is the 138th commencement of the University of Illinois. Let me tell you just a little bit more about our guest. He is trained academically as an economist. He has a PhD in economics from the University of Wisconsin. He's worked some in government. He served as special advisor to the Assistant Secretary for Policy at the U.S. Department of Labor. Was also a staff economist to the U.S. Senate Committee on Human Resources. He has had experience in the academic world. He taught for 15 years at Johns Hopkins University. He was involved in business. He co-founded HCIA, an aggregator of hospital data. He served as president of the Health Insurance Association of America. Also served as executive vice president of Fortis, which is now known as Assurant. He also was president of its health insurance operations. And then in 2002, he was recruited to head the Kauffman Foundation. He's joining us this morning by telephone. And as we talk, questions, comments certainly are welcome. The only thing that we ask of people who are calling in is that people try to keep their questions and comments brief so we can keep moving, get in as many callers as possible. Certainly, though, questions, comments are welcome. 333-9455. Here in Champaign-Urbana, toll-free, 800-222-9455. At any point here, questions certainly are welcome. Dr. Schramm, hello.
Hi, how are you, Dave?
I'm fine, thanks. And yourself?
Just super.
Good. I appreciate you giving us some of your time. There are a number of things that I want to talk about, but as a way perhaps of starting, commencement speakers are expected to say something inspirational and uplifting and send the new graduates off into the world with high spirits. Here now, you're coming to give the talk, and this is a point where, at least as far as the economy is concerned, people are concerned about where things are going, at least in the near term. And I think people are trying to be optimistic, but we're not really quite sure what's going to happen here, at least over the next few years. How do you take that into account as you stand in front of all these graduates who are ready to go off into this difficult world?
Well, I think my speech will be a little different from some of the speeches I've been reading around the country this week, in that I want to talk to graduates in practical and truthful ways. This is not a great economy, and so many of what I've been reading is graduation speeches are sort of inflated, bubbly talk about follow your hearts and, you know, do public service and... It's not surprising. I think one of the sub-themes of many of these speeches is, you know, the worst place you could think of as a smart person to work would be in business. And I think I'm likely to say that, you know, as bad as times are, classes moving from the University of Illinois in years past have faced much, much harder times. And I think in many regards, that's one of the best psychological things to remind people that... even though we're being told this is the worst period of economic downturn since the Depression, that's patently not true. Things were much worse in 1972, for example. faced wars. The year I graduated, 16,000 Americans were killed in Vietnam. There have been many, many worse times. But I think what really is important for the graduates this year is to understand that more than ever before, they have to make their way by themselves. And I think they have to be very, very sober about it. And one of the things that I think, unfortunately, many people are denied is the understanding of actually shaping one's own economic destiny themselves. Over half of the young men and women in that class on Sunday have indicated that at some point they'd like to own their own business or start their own business. That means that's a huge room full of potential entrepreneurs. And one of the things that economists, particularly at this moment, in designing programs to do the recovery, have entirely overlooked is the importance of entrepreneurs to restarting the economy. This is just not part of our national dialogue, despite the fact that in every recession since the Depression, been the creation of new businesses where all the new jobs are created that have restarted the economy, as I say, every single time. So the creation of new business in the hands of entrepreneurs is really critical. And one of the other things I'm going to say is, you know, the University of Illinois has an extraordinary record, just extraordinary. The more I've researched it, the more impressed I am. And it's undeniable, and it's unmistakable, and it's you can't not see it. University of Illinois has produced some of America's greatest, most successful entrepreneurs who have created companies that have changed American life. These are folks who've started drug companies. These are folks who've started major, major software companies. That's one of the particular strengths of your graduates as I see it. Right down to people who've started restaurants. If I got this right, Jimmy John's around the country is the product of two Illinois kids. Mm-hmm. And so I think, in a sense, I'm going to be very, very real about what I want to draw as the picture of the world that college entrants are going into or college graduates are going into. But at the same time, be very, very encouraging that they have been equipped, they are skilled, and notwithstanding a lot of the manipulations going on in the society today with taxes and whatnot, this is still the best place on earth to start a business. And in starting a business, kids, these young graduates, will have the extraordinary understanding of how they are improving social welfare, global social welfare, human welfare, if you will, not just for themselves, obviously, but for all the people they'll employ and for all the wealth they'll make, which is the source of all of our nonprofit wealth and, indeed, all of our tax wealth. Without entrepreneurs, the government will slowly wind down. The nonprofit sector will go out of business. We need these folks to start businesses, advance innovation, create new jobs, and improve society.
Mm-hmm. The kind of things that you've said here about the importance of entrepreneurs to the economy, mm-hmm. and the fact that new businesses, startups provide a lot of jobs. In fact, I think there was at one point a couple of years back that something like half of all of the jobs in the country were in firms. Half of all the jobs created were in firms that were less than 5 years old. And so
it's actually more than that.
It's actually more than that. One thing, though, it also seems that in as much as you've certainly talked a lot about this, your feeling seems to be that people in government, there's people in Washington, and maybe even some of your fellow economists, don't appreciate to the extent that they should just how important entrepreneurship is, that these sorts of facts that you've laid out, people in government don't seem to understand that somehow.
Well, it's not hard to understand that. Now, again, let's just take a benchmark that at least half of the graduates in that class at Illinois on Sunday intend to start a business and want to start a business. In fact, about a quarter of them will work in a new business before they're 30. And a large number of those graduates will work either for themselves, that is, their employer will be themselves, or they will work for somebody they know in that graduating class, somebody they went through college with. Now, That's the reality. We fast forward to government. We can go to Albany, New York. You know, we can go to Madison, Wisconsin. We can go to Springfield. Certainly go to Washington. And now I ask ourselves, of the people who are really holding power, people in the cabinet, people in the Council of Economic Advisors, senators, congressmen who sit on the various economic committees, how many of these folks have ever worked in business, and how many of these folks have ever started a business? Be Republicans or Democrats, cabinets are generally very thin on people who've worked in government, in business. Mm-hmm. So an appreciation for indeed how our nation's wealth is made, certainly an appreciation for the extraordinary, it's an overused word, courage. We should reserve courage for, policemen and soldiers who put their lives at risk. But there's a certain version of courage that's required for people to take the uncharted path of starting a new business. They put everything at risk. It's often said that the reason so many of our businesses are created by immigrants is because when they get here, they have nothing to lose. So their threshold of risk is a good deal lower than that student at Illinois who's sitting there debating whether or not he wants to start a business or she wants to start a business with this great idea they may have learned in engineering school or come upon in engineering school, or take perhaps the safer route, go to Raytheon or, McDonnell Douglas or, Boeing, or IBM. And that's a part of the human drama, and it's a central part of the human drama to all of our welfare that is largely past the experience of most politicians. More and more our politicians start out to be politicians as a career. There will be people sitting in that graduating class who will be in Congress or who will be in the State House in some state, Wisconsin or Nebraska or Maryland, by the time they're 30. They know that right now. That's their game plan. And that's their view of how they're going to go have a secure and, wonderful career. And God love them if it's public service. But I'm not so sure we should extend our love to them if what they're basically saying is, I'll enter a huge political machine, I'll have a secure life forever, and I get to manipulate the welfare of others. Particularly since the welfare of others is really related to the experience of those people sitting just down the row who have no idea of the risks they're going to take to the benefit of the society.
Our guest in this hour of Focus 580 is Carl Schramm. He is president and CEO of the Kauffman Foundation. This is a private foundation that's devoted to entrepreneurship and education. He is trained as an economist and lawyer. He's founded companies in the healthcare, finance, and information technology areas. If you'd like, to read some of his thinking on this subject, you might look at the book that was published a couple of years ago. The title is The Entrepreneurial Imperative, subtitle How America's Economic Miracle Will Reshape the World and Change Your Life. Collins, HarperCollins is the publisher. Questions are welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. You want to take part in the conversation, you can do that. Also, I just want to mention again that our guest this morning, Carl Schramm, will be one of the two speakers at this weekend's commencement ceremonies here at University of Illinois. He'll be giving the afternoon speech. This is at 2 o'clock in the afternoon and coming up this weekend on Sunday. And again, questions welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Let me go back to government for a moment. Certainly, we know that starting a business can be very risky. And at the same time, there are a lot of people who want to do it. And there are people who do it once, and maybe if they're not successful, they don't give up. They go back and they try again. Are there some things you think that government can and should be doing to try to, if not make it easier, then reduce some of the risk and uncertainty?
Oh, David, I think that's a wonderful question, and I do have an answer for it. And I wish just wistfully that you know, politicians would ask that question, because if you see our growth as hinging on more business being formed, you'd want to do everything you could to start more. And if you saw the creation of new businesses as the central venue for job creation, and recessions are measured in part by job creation and certainly the loss of gross domestic product, that's the real measure of it from an economics perspective, you want to do everything possible to have more job creation. And jobs created in the private sector are generally rather permanent. Jobs created in the public sector, you know, are evanescent sometimes. For example, I think last month the federal government put 40,000 new people on the payroll. Most of that's related to the upcoming census. Well, you know, in the year 2011, those jobs don't exist. Anyway, if the government really wanted to see a quick start of a lot more businesses, one thing they might do is for smaller businesses that are new, you'd have some differential rate of payroll taxes, or maybe suspend payroll taxes. My own view is that's the quickest way to get the economy started in any event. The second thing might be to suspend the operation of federal and state regulation on many, many issues related, particularly to labor regulation, until a company had, let's say, 25 employees or 50 employees. So, you know, we have lots of regulations that impose awful heavy costs at the beginning of a firm that just they don't protect people. It's just it's regulation largely for regulation's sake. There's you know, things you could do in terms, in my instance, or the, one of my favorite ideas is if someone starts a brand new business, they employ at least one person or perhaps two people who aren't family members, and the business collapses or fails, give them another year of unemployment insurance. In other words, give them extra protection for having made the start, made the try. So we could be very creative about sending signals to the populace that without a job, maybe the thing to do is to make your own job in a new business. The other thing we could do is make it easier to get a business started and more friendly. I had a story told to me the other day from a young man in New York State who had just incorporated himself. He was going to serve as as a consultant. And 60 days after he'd incorporated himself, he had a stern letter from the state of New York Treasury saying that he was in arrears and a workers' compensation collection of $5,000, and if he didn't pay it within the next 15 days, the state would move to attach his property. Well, you know, if you're a brand-new business person, the nicest how do you do from government ought not to be a letter threatening to take your house. But it goes on all over the country, and it's mindless bureaucracy, but what people don't understand is the signal it sends to people, don't do this. You know, the government's not on your side, and the government's going to come and punish you. And this is just, it's crazy. Now, nobody sets out to do it. You set in place legislation, and then, you know, a faceless bureaucracy takes over, and these are the things that happen. But politicians are powerful enough to basically say, no, we're not going to do that. Let's change the way government behaves. Let's change the way we in the public sector send signals to the private sector to encourage the creation of new jobs through new businesses.
We have some callers to talk with. Let's do that. We'll start off with someone in Effingham. This is our toll-free line, line 4. Hello.
Yes, thank you, David. I am trying to be positive with the programming this morning and the subject matter. But I have to refer again and again back to the idea of entrepreneurialism and the last 70 years, when in my lifetime I have watched the neighborhood grocery store the neighborhood service station, the dry cleaning industry, almost any small enterprise you can think of, have been eaten alive, including now the automotive industry, which started out with some 300 or more of entrepreneurial people who built their own car and put their own name on it. And Eddie Rickenbacker comes to my mind every time. And these people all went bust. Now we're going to have one automaker in this country, maybe, because the population now is 75% employed in service, which means the lowest pay with no benefits. And how can entrepreneurialism solve that problem? If you just stated that you get started, you mortgage your house, and you can't follow through, and the state or some other financial entrepreneur, such as payday loans and title loans and scum like that, who come then and act as a predator upon these people who think they're going to go somewhere. And I give you this much, that they do succeed, but it is, and always refer to the wine cooler. When the wine cooler came along, it exploded there in the 70s, in the early 80s, and Seagram's ate them in a very short time, and the wine cooler just disappeared. So how do you explain those things in the venue that you are speaking?
Well, that's a great question, and this is a very, very complicated subject, and there's no simple answer, but I'll give you a couple of trajectories into what various ways to think about the problem are. Let's start with the auto industry, because I couldn't agree with you more. You know, once upon a time, America had many, many auto companies. There are cities across the country that actually thought they were going to be Detroit, some in Indiana, some in New York State, where companies like Studebaker or Franklin Motors or Pierce Arrow in Buffalo were making great cars. And then, in a matter of decades, there were three big companies. And now it seems that one way to look at what's happening in Detroit right now with the government is this is the antithesis of what one would want from government to stimulate entrepreneurship, but differently. If we let our big corporations fail that are being sustained by the government, acting oddly, some people say this is what happens when the governor, well, when the government's the entrepreneur. I am 1,000% confident that overnight we would have another cycle that you mentioned before of all kinds of new car companies. We would watch some terrific new efficiencies come forward that would be fantastically environmentally friendly, which we're not going to get when these behemoth bureaucratic companies, when they start to have a formal innovation program put upon them by government bureaucrats, we're just not going to have innovation in that industry. It'd be better if we actually let one or two of the companies fail and start all over again. It'd be thrilling new jobs for folks. And my own view is that in no time, the economy of Southeast Michigan, I don't mean to say no time, and it surely wouldn't be painless, but it would be sustainable. And it would have America back on the map. You know, it's inconceivable that America doesn't make much, much more of the world's cars. But the overhead of that industry and its inability to innovate and be entrepreneurial is what holds us back. And indeed, that points to a sort of a second trajectory into your question. Many of our biggest companies are anything but entrepreneurial. Their entrepreneurship is going out and eating competitors. That's certainly a charge levied at, let's say, Microsoft. And as long as these companies become gigantic like this, their urge to be innovative is further and further reduced. And indeed, you point to the wine cooler, and many people much more expert than I am will point to various versions of this type of software or that type of software, which were in fact superior, that disappeared. The companies crush them. And that's one of the difficulties when the political system is used by large companies in, I think, basically a unwholesome symbiosis with professional legislators to protect their market edges. Last thing I might say is this, however, that it's commonly said that, you know, we look around us and the corner grocer's gone and the corner hardware store is gone and the corner, you know, gas station is gone. Now, these are efficiencies that have happened because of entrepreneurs. And, you know, I used to know the name of my hardware dealer, and now I go to Home Depot. Fortunately, I go so often, I actually know one guy there, but who's very friendly, and his inventory is vast compared to the local hardware store, and he's actually quite expert. But I have a hunch I'm referring to the odd clerk at one of these huge companies. But when you look at the contribution of these stores in terms of making products, consumer products, cheaper for America and better for America, it creates a more complex view of this. That is to say, there are studies that indicate that Walmart, and, you know, I happen to be a person who writes and thinks for a living, and I don't get to Walmart but four or five times a year. And I go for very special things like their gigantic sale on Tide or something. But Walmart, to my family, to every household in the country, means a savings in terms of reduced cost for all consumer products of about $2,500 a year. Poor people and rich households are net better off because of the entrepreneurial consolidation in low-end consumer goods. Now, the cost of that is, I don't know my hardware store dealer, Joe, and owner by name, but my Saturday afternoon is lots more my afternoon because I could go to Home Depot. Everything's in one place. They've pushed the products to be much, much easier to use by lay people. Anybody listening to us could go to Home Depot tomorrow and learn how to tile a bathroom. And in the old days, you'd have to bring in a highly paid tile guy to lay it up. So we can't stand in the face of that type of change. And yours is a complicated question, and I apologize. Mine is a complicated answer. But that brings me to the conclusion here, and that is one of the troubles that will happen in a lot of graduation speeches in the next few weeks, one of the troubles in Washington, one of the troubles around, you know, a lot of restaurant tables where people know the answer to everything is nobody knows the answer to everything. These are so complicated, there is no one simple answer. It's always frightening when politicians in particular say, well, to solve this economy, all we have to do is this. To solve the economy, all we have to do is that. And this economy is so complicated, nobody understands it. So we have to be very, very judicious in taking steps to fix it, because the evidence is very clear, terribly clear, that many times when we set out to fix the economy, we make it worse. The housing crisis is the perfect example. Great motivation. We wanted more people to own houses. We pushed more and more public money out through Fannie and Freddie. And the next thing you know, we've induced a housing bubble, and it takes the whole economy down. It was a well-intended public impulse that had unforeseen consequences that have caused a huge disruption in the continued growth of the economy.
We have as our guest in this hour, Focus 580, Carl Schramm. He's an economist by training. He's someone who's had a lot of different jobs in his life right at the moment. He is president and CEO of the Kauffman Foundation. It's a private foundation that's devoted to entrepreneurship and education. He's also been involved in setting up companies in healthcare, finance, and information technology areas. He will be one of two speakers for the commencement ceremonies this weekend here at University of Illinois. It's the 138th commencement, and there will be two big ceremonies and two speakers. In the morning, Susie Orman will speak, and in the afternoon, our guest, Carl Schramm, will speak. If you're interested, by the way, in reading some of his thoughts on entrepreneurship, you might look for his book, The Entrepreneurial Imperative. It was published a couple of years ago, published by Collins. And questions are welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455, where our lines are full here. People will help us by trying to be brief. We'll see if we can get in as many calls.
David, I'll try and be brief as well.
All right.
But I also want to call out that we have a newer book, myself and Will Bommelin, Bob Lighton called
sure.
Good Capitalism, Bad Capitalism. It was published 2 years ago by Yale, and it's now available in 12 languages. As of yesterday, the Italian edition came out yesterday.
All right. People can look for that in whatever language they prefer. We'll go to another caller here, line number one. Hello.
Good morning, Mr. Schramm. Sunday, you're going to be speaking to a crowd that is several decades younger than me, and my question is, how young do you need to be in order to be an entrepreneur?
Oh, boy, that's a great question. You know, lots of people think that, I'll call it the progeny trap, that if you haven't had your great idea by the time you're 19, it's just like being a mathematician or a physicist. You can't be an entrepreneur. Here's a statistic that's sort of arresting. Among the 500 fastest-growing technology businesses in the United States, the fastest-growing newly formed technology businesses, the average age of the founder at the time of starting was 39 years old.
Really?
Yes, and people over 50 outnumber 2-to-1 people under 25 in starting technology companies.
This is good news.
So I like to say that technology, that entrepreneurship, happen. You can't, it's not like I like to say it, the facts are you cannot predict when it's going to happen in the course of someone's life. I'll end by just saying, go puzzle this one out. I know somebody who, when they got out of college, they were 24 years old, and they took a job in the Social Security Administration in Baltimore as a claims examiner. Now, you or I, anybody listening, would say, well, that person surely must have been risk-averse. They just didn't want to see risk. They went to work in the Social Security Administration. Mm. And then when they retired, they started a very successful business.
Mm.
Something happened in their course of life, and I think that's a very important thing for all of our listeners, for everybody on Earth to think about this. You know, your taste for risk, your sense of when you can contribute, your sense that you could contribute. Some kids come out of college and they say, oh, this is never for me. I'm just not that smart. You know, I'll never have a great idea. And one day they'll maybe wake up when they're 42 and say, you know, I'm the smartest person in this room. What am I doing working here? I'm going to go work for myself. This happens. And here's a great question, because so many people I run into think, oh, you know, well, I'm 38 and I'm an engineer. And, you know, I read about these guys who started Facebook. They dropped out of college. Bill Gates dropped out of college. They had the great ideas when they were young. I'm stuck in what I'm doing. And nothing could be further from the truth. Last thing I'd say is, remember the story of Colonel Sanders, who starts Kentucky Fried Chicken, uses his first Social Security check to start the business.
Well, that is an inspirational answer, and I thank you very much.
All right, thank you. Let's go to line number two. This is also someone in Champaign. Hello.
Good morning, David. Good morning, Mr. Schramm.
Hi.
I got to say very briefly that I very much disagree with you about Walmart. I think its impact is precisely the converse of the classic 70s wage-price spiral, and that it hurts people's purchasing power in very similar ways. But that's an entirely different hour of conversation. We could spend many, many hours talking about that. I wanted to ask
you... it's a curious thing, just to say something. I don't carry a brief for Walmart. I don't, you know, as I said, I think I've been to Walmart 3 times in the last year. But it's interesting, whenever I go to a university community, Walmart seems to be part of the weather system. It just is an extraordinary, as a social phenomenon. There's something that goes on in university communities that has Walmart in the middle of you know, their sites.
Oh, sure, yeah, and I'm not particularly interested in bashing Walmart particularly. Mm-hmm. I just think it's a good exemplar of that particular example. But again, anyway, that's neither here nor there. What I wanted to ask you about was the book Natural Capitalism by...
Mm-hmm.
Paul Hawk and Amory Lovins and Hunter Lovins. And
yeah.
I just got
a copy of it last week. I haven't read it yet.
I would highly recommend it to your attention, because it has two very key insights, I think, going forward. The first is that labor is no longer the limiting factor. Natural capital is the limiting factor. The carbon sinks of the atmosphere, the carbon sources coming out of the ground, everything that we have previously treated as raw materials, we need to think of in terms of natural capital, because any business, any economy that eats down its capital and counts it as income will ultimately fail because it is destroying the means by which it generates its productivity going into the future.
Mm-hmm.
And so the allied insight to that is not a call for socialism or anything like that. It's the insight that this breaks most current business models. Most current business models are premised on this idea that you get greater and greater efficiencies and create greater profit margins by capital substitution for labor, whereas, in fact, neither of those things is the limiting factor anymore. The limiting factor is the natural capital.
Mm-hmm.
And those businesses which understand that, which offer efficiency and frugality as the thing that they're selling, such as, for example, the California utility PG&E,
mm-hmm.
which has had decoupling and is now not solely a seller of gas and electricity to its customers, but it sells them solutions for
mm-hmm.
using the energy most efficiently.
Mm-hmm.
That's the way forward. So I wondered if how you're thinking about this in terms of entrepreneurialism might tie into this insight about how capitalism has to change in order to recognize the fact that we live in a full world now and not
mm-hmm.
an empty world.
Just one predicate question. When you say full world, what do you mean?
I mean a world in which the human population and the size of the total economy is bumping up against the limits of the ecosystem.
Okay.
You know, we used to live in, you know, a plane of limitless horizons where there was always somewhere else to go. Well, we've filled pretty much the entire Earth now, and there's nowhere else to go, so we have to learn how to husband what we have and preserve its wealth-generating
right.
and capacity.
Right. Well, again, I'm ignorant on the book because I just got a copy of it. But on the basis of what you tell me, okay, I just have a couple of reactions. And the one is, I know the story of the California utility. I live in Kansas City, and the frustration of many utility companies goes exactly to the issue of, you know, if government would get out of the way, we could actually see some more efficiencies. Utility companies in the country have studied the California example and are anxious to do it. I know our Kansas City Power and Light is, where basically they believe we could, you know, power Kansas City with about 2/3 of the energy we use now if we could, in fact, redistribute the usage of the energy across the day. And the technologies, cheap technologies, exist to do this, particularly around air conditioning is an easy example to understand. But public service commissions won't permit this substitution, and they will eventually. It's just a slow go, and you know this will all be different in 10 years. But you know, like you, I'm anxious to get this underway now. As to the issue of a resource commodity perspective on the economy, which this is obviously, am I right?
Yeah, go ahead. Go ahead.
Yeah. Here's my view of it. I actually see it quite differently. The magic of the economy going forward is more and more decoupled from energy use. I just don't buy that argument. The magic, I mean, I'm going to be talking to a huge room of brilliant kids who've been very, very well trained. And across the country, the growth of our human capital, across the world, the growth of the human capital is fantastic, and we know the more and more we use human capital in the economy, the less we need a commodity-based economy. So I think we're at an inflection point now where a lot of people are very worried because the evident current indications look like we are using more data, we are using more energy, particularly as developing countries come online. But in the United States, we actually are watching per capita decline, certainly in carbon pollution, and that's evidence of a really advancing economy where its dependency on the commodities is going down. Now, you can make the argument that it's going down here because we're buying our raw steel from China, which, and India, China in particular, has no interest, apparently, in watching out for anybody's environment, including the world's environment. But there's one other observation I'd make about this kind of a book. And these books occur from time to time. There's probably nothing new in that book, as there aren't very many ideas that are new in any books, including my own. But the question, the reason I stopped the caller on the question of when he said full up, or the world's full, it's the population argument. And many people make the fallacy, it's a fallacious conclusion, and the data is entirely in the opposite direction, that as population grows, the economies will be diminished or shrunk. This has certainly been the argument of the people who would limit population growth, and it's been their argument since the time of Malthus. And the facts are that as population grows, wealth grows. It's been that way forever. But before you think, oh, well, goodness, this guy on the telephone is going to argue for a limitless population growth, my view is, and again, the data's on my side, as economies become wealthier, population growth declines. So I, for one, do not sign on to the view that, you know, we're at 6 billion now and we will be at 12 billion eventually. My hunch is that's just not going to happen. The world keeps getting wealthier. This is the untold story. It's extraordinary how much wealth there is in the world. And as we get wealthier, we will buy ourselves a much cleaner environment. I even believe China will buy itself a much cleaner environment. I think there's every evidence that that's already a movement starting in China. And, in fact, I suspect that world population growth will top out at 7 or 8 billion people. So I'm always a little worried about completely new theories of the economy. The last time we had a completely new theory of the economy, it was Marxism. You know, hundreds of millions of people are dead because of Marxism. And we have to always be very careful when we think about idyllic or utopian views or urgent views. I understand some of the argument, I think, in that book, but we have to be cautious about how we see it all interacting. Remember what I said before about unintended consequences of things that look obvious.
We just have about 5 minutes left. I'm sure the caller would like to have the opportunity to follow up, but I have one other person here I want to try to get them into, so I hope you won't mind if I go on to this call in Belgium. Line number 4. Hello.
Hello. And I'd like to get back to what the early part of the topic was, in that you were talking about entrepreneurism. Now, because of the way life shook out, I had to become somewhat of an entrepreneur myself, but not really in the concept that you're talking about. I didn't come up with a great idea. I just decided I was going to get involved in a service that's kind of disappearing. I work with wood a lot. I do stuff for individuals. And I've found that I can make a good living. Now, I might not get rich like everybody else, but maybe you should convince some of your students tomorrow that you don't have to be Einstein or come up with the greatest idea. Just come up with an idea that somebody else needs. Thank you very much.
All right. Well, Mr. Schramm?
I have my speech in front of me, and I'm gonna see. I'm going to say you don't have to achieve breakthrough success of this magnitude. I'm recalling in the previous paragraph some extraordinary Illinois graduates who really changed the face of the world. You don't have to achieve breakthrough success of this magnitude to bring real value to your country and its economy. So I hope all of you do. The foundation of our economy is the thousands of small and medium-sized businesses that are formed every year, and they create nearly all of our new jobs. Being part of that story is a form of community and national and even international service. So I think your caller points us all in a wonderful direction. You know, we don't all have to be Bill Gates. But your caller probably has a couple of folks who are working as apprentices. He may have the particular joy of having given work to other people. In many ways, that's one of the highest callings I think we can have, is to secure the lives of other folks. And he makes a really, really important point.
Hmm. We have a couple of minutes left. One of the things that I think that you have said, or maybe I understand you to say, is that maybe one reason why we have pretty high levels of entrepreneurship in the United States is that we're actually pretty tolerant of failure or accepting of failure, and that having tried once and failed, well, people say, okay, so I tried once and failed. We'll try again. It seems that we're willing to say, okay, try and fail. That's not the end of the world. If you fail, try again. Is that something that you think that makes us a little different, perhaps a little different from other people, other places?
It's a huge cultural difference, and to play on the hometown of your last caller, Belgium. I used to run a company that was based in Belgium, the other Belgium. And in Europe, certainly in the Netherlands and in Belgium and in France and in Germany, to start a business and to have failed is a lifelong stigma. In the United States, I've heard it said that your chances of getting venture investment backers is higher if you've been through a couple of failures. We value failure. It's a very important cultural distinction. And I'd say one other thing that's been fantastically important for us in the United States from a cultural perspective is our embrace of immigrants. Immigrants are so important to the creation of new businesses and new jobs in the United States. And one of the things I cannot understand in the world of politicians is this aggressive push to get immigrants out of the United States. You know, even the federal government is enforcing some rules and some firms to push non-Americans who are here legally out of the jobs. And, you know, my own view is there will be kids in that class, young men and women in that class on Sunday, who graduated from the University of Illinois and they're not citizens of the United States. And if their intent was to stay here and create jobs, I'd give them citizenship tomorrow. America is becoming very hostile to immigrants, and it's a really dumb policy to pursue that or to think that, even personally, certainly politically.
Mm-hmm. I mentioned probably a couple of points that you are an economist, that's where your academic background lies and your training is. So,
David, quit telling people that. economists are probably the most most discredited profession on earth, right?
No, seriously. No one will think badly of, oh, well, okay, if you want. But as we all know, there's no money in cultural anthropology. I don't know if there's any money in being an economist either. But I suppose the risk of being an economist is then people will say to you, they'll ask you the kind of question like I'm about to. So,
yeah.
So, tell me, Mr. Economist, given where we are now, where do you think we're going to be in another year or two?
Oh, well, economists come in two stripes. There are pessimist economists and optimist economists. And when I wasn't an economist, before I became a cultural anthropologist or something else, no offense to cultural anthropologists, by the way, I was an optimistic economist, and I think I'm still very optimistic. I think, actually, at the moment, there are some signs that our economy, even without the stimulus engaged, is starting to come back. And I don't think that's much of a surprise, frankly. I think if we could wash out some of the toxic assets in banks even faster, let some of these banks collapse, as I think they should have last year, we'd be faster into the recovery. So my hunch is a year from now things will look somewhat better, but they'll be sort of formalistically better. We'll have new numbers on growth. I think productivity will be up, but like usual, unemployment will be following some months behind, and then we'll have real wage growth will follow that. So it won't feel to people who are without jobs right now like the recovery's underway, but GDP will be up, productivity will be up. A lot of firms are figuring out how to do more with fewer people. But as we have growth, there'll be new jobs, and many of these jobs will be wonderful and better jobs, and there will be higher wages coming along behind that. That's the normal pace of economics, and you can't change it. You just can't change how economies decline and how economies recover. You can prevent a lot of declines, as we could have prevented this one with better housing policy and having forbidden the derivatives market to have been established. And you can also prevent recoveries by, again, government policy that's well-intended, but in fact has effects that people don't really want to emerge.
Just real quick. You talked about the fact that at the commencement, of the people who are sitting there getting ready to receive degrees, maybe over half of them would say it would be their ambition to have their own business.
Mm-hmm.
So we know universities already seem to be a pretty good breeding ground for entrepreneurs. But are there other things that you think that somehow within our education system and, maybe even at the secondary level, if not below, that the somehow the idea, the entrepreneurial impulse could be fostered?
Well, I think that's a great, great question. And I'd invite your listeners, if any of them have kids who are in high school or grandchildren in high school, ask to see their history book, their American history book. Some American history books do not have the word entrepreneur in. And many American history books will spend pages and pages and pages and pages on topics that aren't all that important to American history. And there'll be three or four pages about the formation of big businesses. So there'll be a treatment of Henry Ford, and it won't be flattering. There'll be a treatment of John Rockefeller. It will not be flattering. Okay. There'll be a passing reference to Bill Gates, maybe. And that's where you'll first see the word entrepreneur. But the general story, the real story about how America was made and how the freedom of action and political freedom was converted into the machinery of making wealth and improving the welfare for all people, will just not be told. And it is essentially the story. I would refer people to a fantastic book by Harry Evans called They Made America. It was a PBS special about 4 years ago. And it really tells the story of the entrepreneurial spirit of America and how critical it's been to the securing of our democracy.
Pardon me for interrupting you there, Mr. Sharma. We're simply going to have to stop. I'm sorry to say we've used our time, but I want to say to folks, again, our guest, Carl Schramm, he's president and CEO of the Kauffman Foundation. He's one of the two speakers this weekend at the 138th commencement here at University of Illinois, Urbana-Champaign. And thanks very much for talking with us.
Thanks, David.